Okay, this is Nick Szczepanik, and I'm with Neil Fitzsimon, who's the author of Rhapsody in Blue. This is a book subtitled How I Fell in Love with the Great Chelsea Team of the Early 70s, which more or less sets the stall out. And if you're in any doubt, the cover photograph shows Peter Housman congratulating Peter Osgood after he'd equalised in the FA Cup replay against Leeds United at Old Trafford. Neil, good to speak to you.
Yeah, hello there. Nice to speak to you, Nick.
Perhaps for the younger readers of your book, you could begin by sort of setting the scene for us about what football and the football landscape was like at the time of that great Chelsea team in the early 70s. The early 70s, late 60s, how different was football and the world in general from the one we know today?
Well, yeah, in my opinion, it was totally different. I mean, in those days, you know, you had the match of the day and the big match. And if you wanted really to see your team live, that's what you had to do. You had to go to the games. I mean, the only like club game that was shown live in those days was the FA Cup final. So, yeah, after the 1967 final against Spurs when Chelsea lost 2-1, I was plaguing my dad for the next 15 or 16 months to take me to a game because it was a bit of a cross I had to bear that I'd never actually seen them play. So, yeah, finally he gave in and took me to a game. And it was a big thing in those days, going to a game. It really was. I mean, the first time you go is an occasion you'll never forget.
A very different sort of football experience from all-seater stadiums.
Yeah, oh, totally, yeah. I mean, it was much more visceral, I think, in those days. Even though, the first game I went to, we sat in the old East Stand at Stamford Bridge. I wasn't allowed to go anywhere near the shed. I asked, but my dad said, no, it was full of hooligans and there's no way that he was going to take me there. So we ended up in the old East Stand and... I forgot actually to write about it in the last book, but I missed both goals that day, so I never saw both got in a 1-1 draw because my dad made me leave 5 minutes to go, and then as we were leaving, going through the main gates at the bridge, there was a dull roar and somebody came running out the ground and said that Mike O'Grady had just scored for Leeds. And I, you know, in a way, I was disappointed because I'd never seen a goal scored a game. And then my dad said, oh, well, never mind. You know, you didn't want to see that lot score, did you? And then we got a little bit further down the road and there was a tremendous roar. And another bloke ran past us. My dad said, what's happened? He said, Osgood just equalised. And I couldn't speak to my dad on the way. I wouldn't even look at him. You know what I mean? So he then promised to take me to the next home game, which was against Wolves in a couple of weeks. And Chelsea missed, and Wolves scored from a penalty. And then Chelsea missed a penalty, Osgood took it. And then again, my dad, with 5 minutes to go, said, come on, they're not going to score in a month of Sundays. And I just said, I'm not leaving. And with that, Chelsea rewarded a penalty in injury time, and Osgood scored it. So yeah, my dad got out of jail that day, really, because I think I would have gone mad if I'd have gone to two home games and not seen one goal scored.
I know, yeah, that might have changed the course of your life if he'd missed again.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But it's one thing, obviously, you know, supporting a club and for as long as you obviously have, but another thing perhaps wanting to write about that. I mean, what made you want to write a book about this?
Well, I think I'd always had an idea to write about it, and I was prompted by my partner Trudy for years to write something because, as you know, I've worked in the music business and I've written quite a lot of songs that have been in a few TV things and in films. And you know, she said, you got away with words, why don't you write, you know, a book about all your experiences, because I told her so many of these like anecdotes, like, you know, hundreds of times. So I started putting it down, and I wanted really to write a book that was a little bit different to a normal football book where it just went on about results and then we played so and so. And then I wanted something a little bit more like, you know, like based on that Cider with Rosie, something like that, like what it was like to grow up in those days and the, you know, the loss of innocence and how you'll never quite ever get that back again.
Well, some would say that that watching games from the shed at Chelsea was a definite loss of innocence. I mean, you did get in there eventually, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I plagued my dad after the Wolves game to take me again to a game, and he kept on promising. And in the end, there was a big showdown one night between me and my dad, and he turned on me and said, "Well, go on your own then." So I said, "Yeah, all right, I will." Much to like the alarm of my mum and my nan and granddad, because I suppose what was I then? I was 13. And I was going to the games on my own, and it was known as being, it could be a lot of trouble at these games. But no, I stuck to my guns, and the first game I went to on my own was against Sunderland in about February, March 69. And we won 5-1. Bobby Tamblyn got 4 goals, and that was it. I went to about another 7 home games that season on my own. And everything, and that was, I was totally into it then. And I stood in the shed end, just albeit to one side near the tea bar. I didn't quite have the guts to go into the middle of it.
Because Stamford Bridge then was a very different ground, wasn't it? But the shed end, there was quite a distant view because there was a dog track around the outside, and you mentioned the old East Stand, which is quite a lot set back from the pitch, and the rather enclosed Stamford Bridge, with the hotels around it, is a completely different experience, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah, I always thought it was a drawback, Stamford Bridge, in a way. I didn't realise how much of a drawback it was until I started going to some of the away games in London, like in the first seasons that I went to. When I went to like West Ham and everything, I couldn't believe how close you were to the players. You're almost right on top of them, and the atmosphere that generated. But yeah, I mean, I love the old Stamford Bridge, saying that the first couple of seasons with that ridiculous like old North Stand stuck in the corner that looked like a warehouse on stilts.
It was a real afterthought, wasn't it? Just sort of stuck there strange thing.
Yeah, I don't know if that was built I think I've read somewhere that they built that like with the Greyhound racing that they used to have there for like the different punters to stand underneath that or something, and they used to use the shed as that as well. But it was, it was collapsing by the mid 70s, and nobody was allowed in it, I don't think, because it used to shake in high winds, which is a bit weird. Yeah. Yeah, it's strange that the ground went from looking elegant to me, but then by the time, the decline had started, and of course, when they knocked down the old East End, the ground was like really depressing. It was like a building site.
It was the team on it that probably caught your attention. And it's the book is unashamedly fan's eye view of a team, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, I mean, I worship them. I still do in a more refined way now, but they could do no wrong. I mean, I actually wrote to Bobby Tamblyn back in those days, and I got these testimonial brochure back with a letter from him thanking me for my support. So, he was undoubtedly my hero when I first started supporting them, but I've always felt a bit guilty that that season that they won the FA Cup, he lost his place in the team early on, and Ian Hutchinson came in, and the partnership was formed with Osgood, and I had like kids of my age forgot all about Bobby Tamblyn, which was a bit sad really.
And he ended up going to Crystal Palace, didn't he?
He did, yeah, and I think he came back and scored against us as well in a 1-1 draw the following year at the Bridge.
Yeah, I mean, that team, people of a certain age can probably reel it off or near as. And I suppose the big stars were obviously Peter Osgood, Charlie Cook, later Alan Hudson. But Hutchinson is a figure, who looms large in your book, and obviously a bit of a favourite of yours.
Oh, yeah. He was definitely... Well, I think, looking back on it now, he wasn't a typical Chelsea player, to be quite honest, because he didn't have the skill of Osgood, but he was like the battering ram that took the pressure of Osgood. And, I think it's no accident that Osgood had his best ever season at Chelsea that year and scored 31 goals And Hutchinson, I think, weighed him at about 26. And I thought he was a brilliant, brave player. And he was scared of nobody. When Leeds came to the Bridge and they actually beat us, he absolutely terrorised Norman Hunter and Jack Charlton. And he actually, like, I remember seeing him once clean out Tommy Smith, which was hysterical. So, yeah, I admired him. I think it was because he wasn't the norm at Chelsea. We weren't known for having players like that, but he brought a bit of grit to the side. And he's, to be quite honest, he's always been my my favourite Chelsea player of all time. I know it seems a bit strange, but I think it's also the fact that his career was cut short by so many terrible injuries as well that has made him more of a legend.
Yeah, although I suppose to the wider world outside the, you know, the Chelsea diaspora, he's not as well remembered, almost forgotten compared to those, you know, the names like Osgood.
Yeah.
Except, of course, for the long throw, he was possibly one of the first, you know, who was well known for the long throw simply because Chelsea were on the TV so much.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone had ever seen anything like it. And then all of a sudden, other teams like Spurs and everything started getting their own long throw experts. I think they used Martin Chivers. But I remember, like, in 1973, I went to Peter Housman's testimonial at the Bridge, and they had a long throw-in competition before, I think, at half-time or before the game. And Chivers was there and a few other players, and Hutchinson just beat them by miles. It was like almost freakish how far. And the thing about him was he could actually vary the type of throws that he put in. You know, the one against Leeds and everything was a bit of a mixture of both. It was like thrown at pace and like angled to that near post. So yeah, he was unbelievable.
But obviously, you know, the Hudson and Osgood also featuring your book. Charlie Cook perhaps a little less, but I suppose it's the goal scorers like Osgood who are always going to get the.
Oh yeah, I mean, I love Charlie Cook as well. I mean, it was great. I think the only thing you could point against him was that his lack of goals, which was a bit of a rarity. But yeah, he was one of the players I loved. I thought he was a fantastic player. He's one of the old school of dribbling with the ball, which is a thing really that has disappeared a lot from the modern game now. I know there's a few that could still do it, but that I think they used to call them Tanner Ball Kings up in Glasgow, where they played with the tennis ball and they had full control of it. And he was an amazing player. But as you say, Osgood, he was like the king. And I think he still remains that to this day, to be quite honest.
But you make the point in the book that the image of that Chelsea team was a sort of bunch of West End playboys.
Yeah.
But that's not even half the story, is it really, when you look at some of the more solid citizens and some of the, I suppose someone would think rather brutal defenders of the same team.
Yeah. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, you take people like David Webb and Dempsey. And Ron Harris could certainly mix it. And then you had McCready, who was...
overlooked assassin of that back four, wasn't he?
He is, yeah. And he was quite... I mean, I've watched back some of those old games, you know, like that they've shown them on TV. I can't remember if it was on BT Sport. I used to get Chelsea TV and they showed them. And as well as being like... He was a very, like, good footballing fullback, but my God, he was not... scared of mixing it. And you know, of course, I suppose he's most famously known for the kung fu kick clearance in the cup final against Leeds.
Yeah, we'll come on to that cup final. Then of course, yeah, there was also, you know, there's the John Hollins, Peter Housman, you know, the slightly overlooked because they weren't going to pick up bookings, but they possibly weren't going to get as much of the glory.
Yeah, I mean, Hollins was a really brilliant midfielder. I mean, he ran all day, didn't he? And he had a fantastic shot on him. I think he was a bit unlucky that he, Alan Mullery, was preferred in midfield for in the England team by Sir Alf Ramsey. I always thought that was a bit... I think he only ever won one cap, John Hollins. I think that was against Spain in 67. And Housman, yeah, I mean, I've got to admit, you know, I fell into the trap of calling him Mary, which was a bit... mean, but because he didn't look like he looked.
Was that a common nickname that he had around the bridge, or was that just the Octopus?
No. He got called that all the time, unfortunately, because he wasn't. He didn't tackle back or anything like that, but he was a very clever winger and a brilliant crosser of the ball. But because I think he didn't fit that image of the Chelsea team, he had like a short back and sides. And as I said in the book, he looked a bit like a bank clerk. He was the first one that the Chelsea crowd, because he had a style that was very laid back. It wasn't an all-action style. But as I say, I've watched the cup finals back against, and he was a really clever player. Really good. And I felt a bit guilty now. And he got some really, what was some unfair stick from the crowd. It was merciless sometimes, to be quite honest.
Yeah. Of course, you didn't go on your own to every game. And the book contains quite a lot of stuff about friends and friendship and the sort of camaraderie of going to games. But also there's an element of this street football and what you did away from going to Chelsea. And a sense of what it was like, really, to be a teenager in those days.
Yeah. I think it's a sad thing now that culture of street football has, like, disappeared. Because I think in the book I said in those days, you could go anywhere, really, and find some kids playing football and ask to join in, as I did when we first moved out to Hemel Hempstead. And those friends that I got on with were friends of mine, still friends of mine today. So it was a brilliant way of meeting people. It was not just football, it was a social thing as well. And I do, I'm saddened that you rarely see that now, kids playing football in a park or on we actually, when we were playing the fields we went to, we were trespassing every time because it was school football fields, but that didn't stop us, and we formed our, that they'd already formed a team by I got there with their own kit and everything and played other street teams. And it was great. It was, when I first moved, I didn't know anybody, and through that, I made loads of new friends.
Quite a lot of the book talks about the run to that FA Cup final, and there's quite a lot in that. Obviously, it was that Chelsea team's first trophy, but it also points up, what the FA Cup meant in those days, compared to a rather sort of downgraded status it has nowadays.
Yeah, it was the be-all and end-all. When I first started supporting the club, the thing that I wanted them to win more than anything was the FA Cup, especially after the defeat against Spurs in 67. It was the holy grail for the club because there was actually a musical song in the 30s called The Day Chelsea Won the Cup, and all these improbable things would start happening and everything. So it was a monkey on our back, really, that we hadn't won it. And it was viewed in this country like everything stopped on that day, like with the build-up, which was fantastic to it, meet the teams at the hotels, and it's a cup final knockout and all that. My family, used to make a day of it. My mum used laid on hot dogs and everything like that. And I'd always bought the programme from the news agent during the week. I don't think people can... I suppose back then it was viewed almost like of winning like what the Champions League is now. It was more coverage and glory went to the cup winners rather than the league champions.
Yeah, FA Cup final day was a whole event, wasn't it? As you say, it was. With the TV coverage and because it was the only live club game, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah, because I think the League Cup final was only shown on a Sunday afternoon. The highlights of it took quite a while. The cup final was everything. On the way up to Stamford Bridge on the train, I used to go past Wembley, when I was going to the Chelsea games, and just to see the Twin Towers and all the flags flying and everything. And when I knew that we'd got there for the final against Leeds, I could feel my stomach dropping away every time I saw it with nerves about what it was going to be like to go there. Yeah, it was... It was the most important club game, I would say, in the world at the time. It was shown all around the world.
I was struck by your description of going to the semi-final against Watford, which was at White Hart Lane, and that's another sort of Chelsea won 5-1 in quite an easy fashion in the end. But it wasn't really what was going on the pitch that was significant for you, that, because I think you went to the game with your sister, and it was it was a reminder of what a very uncomfortable experience going to football could be in those days.
We were down, I think it's at the Park Lane in the corner, like where it joins onto the shelf, and all of a sudden a load of latecomers came in, and obviously like had been drinking, and they started shoving from the back, and we all went down, you know, like those things you see when everyone goes tumbling downwards. And unfortunately we were pushed right against the crash barrier and getting quite crushed against it. And luckily I managed to push back on it and get my sister underneath, and I got underneath, but some of my friends behind weren't so lucky. I think there was some bloke near us, so you know, I didn't know him at all. His arm was broken with the pressure. One of my mates fainted because I saw him being carried over the heads of of people. I got my sister out down to the front, just out onto the small running track when Chelsea scored the first goal. But she was absolutely terrified, my sister. And you know, I'd been in a few crushes before, but I'd never been in anything like that, and it really was just a foretaste, you know, of all, we all know what happened later.
Yes, indeed. What happened later is for Chelsea was what you'd almost dreaded, which was the cup final against Leeds, who at that time were obviously a significant force, the Don Revie team, and had previously battered Chelsea at Stamford Bridge 5-2, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. We were 2-1 up at half time. I think Leeds scored first, and then we came back with I think John Hollins and Peter Oscar scored. But in the second half, they were unbelievable. I remember like Terry Cooper, their fullback, who I thought was an excellent player. He scored from about 25 yards out, that made it 2-2, and they just took us to pieces, really. The only defence I can make of Chelsea is that we didn't have Benetti in goal. It was Tommy Hughes in goal that day, and he didn't exactly cover it.
Yes.
Yeah, he didn't cover himself in glory actually that day, but. Yeah, I mean they looked frightening. To be quite honest, they were tough. They complained about every decision that was going, and some of the tackling was, you know, as bad as I think as the cup final. I mean, you could still see that game on YouTube, and yeah, they were quite brilliant. So I don't know. You know, I always believed that we would win the cup that year. I don't know what it was, just like being that young and everything. But yeah, I was. There's no doubt about it. I was absolutely, you know, all teams I didn't want to face. I was really hoping that United would get through in the other semi-final against Leeds, but I think I knew deep down what was going to happen. And yeah, we had to face, that formidable team.
Yeah, I mean, just mentioning that Peter Benetti wasn't in goal. Obviously, Peter Benetti died recently, but what a unique presence he was. You know, not particularly the tallest goalkeeper, but obviously nicknamed the Cat for his extreme agility.
Yeah, he was great. I mean, the way that he plucked crosses out of the air, as you said, he's a brilliant shot-stopping goalkeeper. Absolutely fantastic. As I put in the book, I don't think he was ever quite the same after the nightmare of the defeat to the Germans in the World Cup in 1970, when he carried the can for that, which I thought was a little bit unfair, to be quite honest, because the England defence and Sir Ralph Ramsey had something to do with that as well, I think. I would only put him at fault, really, for the Beckenbauer goal. Yeah, he was a fantastic goalkeeper. As you said, not the tallest. I don't think he was not 6 foot, was he? I think he's about 5'10", something like that, 5'9", 5'10". Yeah, but a great shot-stopping goalkeeper. And he saved us in those two cup finals. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, because the Wembley game perhaps wasn't the greatest game technically, but part of that was because of the atrocious state of the Wembley pitch, which in those days they allowed things like the Horse of the Year show on it, and wasn't the manicured surface that we know today.
No, right, it was a beach. It was just really. I mean, I watched the game for the purpose of the book a few months ago, and what really impressed me is that on that surface, both teams just went at each other from start to finish. there was, you know, Chelsea would have a go, then Leeds would have a go, even though Leeds, you know, should have won that day, to be quite honest. You know, they gifted us the first goal, you know, with Houseman when Gary Sprake dived over the ball. But the one thing you can say is that Chelsea never gave in. I mean, even when we went 2-1 down with 7 minutes to go, then Hutchinson scored that equaliser. And I think most surely that was a turning point, because I think Leeds most surely believed, you know, that everything was going to turn to ashes for them that season, because they've been so close to everything, and then it was taken away from them again. But I thought, yes, you're right. I mean, technically, most probably it wasn't great, but there was a real like swashbuckling attitude from both sides.
You could make the case that the pitch played a part in both the first two goals, because Jack Charlton's header didn't bounce on the line; it sort of died and two Chelsea players sort of kicked over the ball. And then, of course, that shot by Houseman bounced under Sprake when it might have bounced into his body on a livelier pitch, possibly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The first one. Yeah, I was right behind that goal when that happened. I didn't know what had happened, really. Look, I just saw it being headed. As so often, you know, when you go to games like that, you can't really see as much as what you can on the TV. Ron Harris was protesting. I don't know what he's protesting about. I think for a foul on Benetti. And as you say, the equaliser, I mean, Tommy Baldwin has always claimed that it was him running in on Sprake so quickly that made Sprake take his eye off the ball. So, yeah, it came out of nowhere, really, that goal, didn't it? Because it was quite a tame shot.
Yeah. But Hutchinson equalised with a rather brave near post header just after Leeds had taken what seemed to be a winning lead. But I think Leeds would probably say that they'd gone to a couple of replays against Manchester United in the semi final, and they'd played Celtic in the European Cup semi final. They were playing an unbelievable number of games, whereas Chelsea, I suppose, were relatively fresh.
Yeah, we were. I mean, you know, we finished third that season, and our form. Like before that, the first cup final at Wembley, and in between that, it wasn't great. We lost to West Brom, we lost to Burnley. I think we beat Liverpool.
And you lost home. Alan Hudson to injury as well, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that was against West Brom, I think, on Easter Monday. He turned his ankle over, didn't he? I think he wasn't tackled. I think I've read that his ankle just went over in a divot. And that was it. I mean, I think they tried hard as much as they knew in those days. I think they actually put his ankle in plaster, which is about the worst thing you can do. I think he actually went to see faith healers as well. He was so desperate to play. And I think he most probably thought there might be a chance of the replay, but no such luck. And he was definitely a miss in that final. There's no doubt about that.
Although they didn't get Hudson back for the replay, which was at Old Trafford, they made Dave Sexton made a tactical change at the back, didn't he? And he swapped David Webb and Ron Harris over, so that it was Ron Harris who was up against Eddie Gray, who really tortured David Webb in the first game.
Yeah, they did. I don't think David Webb ever really like played at fullback again. He was more or less like a centre back from then on. I think it was Dempsey and Webb in the middle from then on. I mean, Harris was obviously told to do a job on Eddie Gray, and he cleaned him out, you know, I think in the first 15 minutes. And I think Eddie Gray didn't fancy it so much after that. And it worked, you know. Again, though, in the replay, it just seemed that where it ended at Wembley, it started off again at Old Trafford with Leeds like dominating everything in that game, and we were under pressure, you know, right from minute one.
But it's also gone down in history as being one of the most violent games. You mentioned in the book that Total Football magazine arranged for David Ellery to re-referee it by modern standards. I think there was, about six red cards he would have shown, something like that. And in the actual game, there was only one booking.
Yeah, that was Ian Hutchinson, I think, for shoving Billy Bremner over Oscar's outstretched legs. I've watched those tackles back. They're unbelievable. I particularly like the way that Hutchinson, when Bremner was complaining, did the like yap, yap, yap thing in his face with his hands and everything. But I mean, the crowning glory must go to Eddie McCready, for which was one of the most ludicrous tackles I think I've ever seen. And the referee, I think there's a joke. There was a joke going around that he went for his pocket and just pulled a hanky out instead of a, you know, like a, well, there weren't cards in those days. But I mean, it's just the way he waved play on.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's photographs of it. You know, to say it was slightly out of control would be the grossest of understatements, wouldn't it? These days, he wouldn't have to. VAR wouldn't need to look at it for more than a couple of seconds.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think I wrote in the book that, you know, like, they were like Scotland teammates as well, Bremner and McCreedy. And he patted Bremner on the head. And I put in the book, I don't know if he's checking if he's all right, or if his head had become detached from his body. Because, I mean, you know, it was so dangerous. I mean, if that had just been a little bit lower, I mean, God knows what would have happened. Because, but, you know, the thing is, as I said in the book, that night when I saw, I didn't really think that much about it at all. No one really, if you watch the crowd reaction is and the Leeds players, there's no call for a penalty. They just like get on with it.
Yeah. No, completely. Well, as we said, completely different times in terms of the disciplinary stuff as well as the experience of, I think it was, you were on the Stretford end, is that right?
The Stretford end.
Chelsea end, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were offered, me and my sister were offered tickets in the, in one of the stands. I think it was the stand where they went up to get the cup at the end, because my dad worked with Victor Roughton. I don't know if you remember him. He worked he worked with his sister, and he used to get me tickets for cup finals. I mean, bit shamefacedly, I went to cup finals, or that I didn't support the teams because Victor. So I used to go to these games, and he got us tickets for that, yeah. But he said about the stand, but I wanted to be on the Stretford end. We both wanted to be there. Mm. And we were accompanied by some older Chelsea supporters that night. That was the only reason we were allowed to go.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's quite an interesting part of the way you sort of managed to talk your way into getting someone to go with you or look after you on the night, yeah. So, you do what you've got to do, I suppose, to get to...
And when I first met, because I was like 13 when I met him and he was 27, of course, you know, my parents were dubious about all this and everything. But no, he was a lovely bloke, Dave. And, you know, unfortunately for him, he got saddled with two kids and everything, which didn't do his ego any good, I suppose, because we were, you know, looked upon as being like, you know, spare parts, I think, on the night.
I mean, the consequence of winning the cup was that Chelsea played in Europe and got through to the Cup Winners' Cup final against Real Madrid. But unluckily, you weren't able to go to that. And it's kind of rather strange that these days, when you think of that, it wasn't broadcast live on TV.
It's almost unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, I said in the book that I actually went down the fields to play football for the early part and then came back to listen to the game on the radio. And they had the England-Wales home international on, which I had absolutely no interest in, which finished as a goalless draw. And I had that painful thing where Real Madrid equalised in the last few seconds. And then I sat in the kitchen for the extra time with my sister. She'd come home by that time. And it was excruciating because they absolutely bombarded us in that. And I think there's actually footage now of like David Webb making an overhead kick clearance from underneath the bar. To get the ball off the line. As it turned out, I mean, it turned out for the best because the replay was shown on the Friday night on the BBC. And
that was the one we had that fantastic John Dempsey volley in.
I think it's from a Charlie Cook corner and he headed it towards the goal and it was headed back to him and he just smacked it into the roof of the net, which was a bit of a shock.
But, I mean, what was kind of incredible, even at the time, was that the game took place only 2 days later, you know, and there's no recovery time there. But I don't suppose in those days they even worried about it. And the players just stayed on. And I guess the fans who'd gone for the first game just had to sort of quickly rebook some hotels. And
yeah, that's right. I mean, the legend is that they all went on the booze the following day, the Chelsea players. Sexton decided to let them off the leash a bit and Osgood and Hudson, all the other, you know, the guilty parties were around the pool drinking and everything. And I think McCreedy and I think Charlie Cook were quite liked to drink and Tommy Baldwin. But yeah, that they came through it. I think Osgood is known as saying, you know, they said, right, that's it, we're going to do it this time. And they stuck together. I mean, I don't think Osgood was really that fit for the final because he'd picked up an injury. about a month before, and it was touch and go. And I think John Hollins actually missed the replay because he was injured in the first game.
Mm. But I suppose that's people like Brian Clough took a leaf out of that playbook, didn't they? He'd occasionally, you know, take the players out and tell them to go and get drunk and, you know,
yeah,
perhaps not with such a short space between games.
No. It was a bit ridiculous when you think about it. But well, it paid off on that occasion. But I mean, it was a dodgy thing to do to let them just give them a free rein. Because I'm very unlike Dave Sexton, I think, who always struggled with like the so-called like star players in the teams. I think that was the undoing of him.
Yeah, I mean, these days winning an FA Cup and then winning a European trophy would be, you know, people would be writing about it as the start of a dynasty and a team that was going to go on to great things. But it really didn't happen at all, did it?
No, it didn't. No. I'd noticed in that season that we won the Cup Winners' Cup. I think we finished sixth that year, and the team were not as consistent. I mean, they missed Hutchinson, and by then, he'd torn a cartilage, and then he broke his leg. And we bought Chris Garland the season after the Cup Winners' Cup, but we never really found a replacement for him. I mean, you know, we tried Bill Garner out, and I could see an inconsistency with the team. It didn't have that that tough mental toughness that the Cup winning team of 70 had. And by the start of 71, that started off badly. I mean, we got hammered against Arsenal on the opening day. Then we lost at home to Man United. And Osgood was put on the transfer list that night as well. So it was a pretty mediocre start. But, I mean, we picked up. I think we finished seventh. And unfortunately, we got to the League Cup final and lost that, which was that was the start of all the troubles, I think. Mm.
And then also we mentioned, Stamford Bridge. They started the redevelopment, didn't they? And they knocked down that old East Stand and built the present one that's still there. But that was a financial millstone, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Because the one thing they didn't need was the results to start turning on the pitch. And that's exactly what happened. It was a pretty desperate time to be going. There was just one side of the ground being a building site and porter cabins that they were getting changed in. And Dave Sexton had the idea it might be a good idea to keep the players out on the pitch and do the team talks there at half-time. And you could gradually see it, that teams were starting to fancy themselves against it there. And he didn't seem to know his best team. He constantly put Alan Hudson out on the wing to accommodate Steve Kember. And Hudson was not happy there. You could tell that. And I felt, and I think, you know, the mates I went with, just a sense of foreboding that things were going a little bit pear-shaped. We picked up well that season when we got to the League Cup final. I think we went 16 games unbeaten, but definitely that week in late February, early March 72, that really was... the beginning, I think, of the decline.
Yeah, and eventually ended up with relegation and something that probably, you know, you couldn't have imagined in those days when they were winning the FA Cup that would be the consequence of, of everything that went wrong.
Well, yeah, I mean, the crucial game was when we lost to Spurs at White Hart Lane. It was basically between us and them who went down, and they beat us 2-0 that day. And I've written in the book about how we unbelievably bumped into Jack Taylor, who'd refereed the game that day on the tube train. He was sitting next to us, which seems incredible that he was on this train packed with Chelsea, and he disallowed a couple of Chelsea goals as well that day. So he was a brave man.
Butcher from Wolverhampton. Well, he wasn't a guy that anyone would probably have walked up to on a train and sort of taken issue with. He looked like a guy who was quite happy handling himself.
Well, yeah.
I mean, we talk about those days, the 70s. I mean, that was a decade when Manchester United, Chelsea and Tottenham were all relegated.
It is, yeah. It's hard to imagine that United going down. I can remember that, not quite believing what was going to happen and everything. Actually, I saw them at Stamford Bridge a few weeks before they were relegated, and they still managed to beat us 3-1. So it shows you what state we were in. I've got to say, I enjoyed every minute of it. Not quite as much as Spurs going down in 77, because Chelsea got promoted that year. So we said, you know, we went in opposite directions. I mean, that was like a dream come true that they went down. But unfortunately, we then shot ourselves in the foot by getting rid of the manager who'd won us promotion.
It was Eddie McCready, wasn't it?
It was, I can remember coming in from college and everything, and just reading on the back of a local newspaper, McCready resigns as Chelsea manager. I just couldn't believe it, because I mean, he'd got us up with no money and a very good young side and everything, and it was
led
all
by Ray Wilkins, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. I mean. I saw Ray Wilkins make his debut against Norwich in 73 as a Friday night game. And he looked really good then. And then he like was in and out of the side. But I think in the 74, 75 relegation season, around about Christmas time, he secured a regular place and was made captain for that Spurs game, which we lost. And Ron Stewart, I think it was... Oh, no, it was Eddie McCready was managing that day. By then, he'd taken over. He left out John Hollins, Ron Harris, and put in youngsters that day. So we could see which way it was going. But I thought he was an excellent player, Ray Wilkins. I think he played his best football ever at Chelsea, to be quite honest. I think Man United put the shackles on him.
He became known for these sort of raking forward passes and long diagonals and everything, and that was completely moved out of his game by Manchester United, wasn't it?
It was. Well, he picked up that nickname, didn't he, as United, the Crab. He just went sideways all the time. I think that was something with Sexton's. I don't know what he was playing at, really, because I didn't recognise him as a player. He showed what he was capable of at United in that cup final against the team that you support. I don't want to go over that, but that one that he curled into the top corner.
That's the only time he'd actually sent the ball forward, I think, after leaving Chelsea, unfortunately.
Yeah, I didn't want to mention that one, yeah.
Obviously, it all worked out okay for Chelsea, and, you know, they became one of the great powerhouses of Europe and won the Champions League in 2012, which must have been a great moment for you, but I believe still doesn't quite overshadow that first FA Cup win.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I've got to admit, the night they won the Champions League, I didn't go to the final. I was at home watching it, which was, you know, yourself being a football supporter, was just like 2 hours and whatever of absolute torture, with a penalty shootout thrown in just for good measure. And, you know, what happened to us the time before. It was a fantastic night. I didn't sleep that night, and I had quite a few drinks as well. But still, that thrill of seeing them win the FA Cup in Manchester that night, for me, it's an unforgettable experience. And I can reel that team off just straight off the bat of the Chelsea team that won it. I know, you know, everything about them. I don't know. It's an iconic moment in the club, really. And I think it makes, you know, a big difference when you're there and you've witnessed it and you've seen the cup, which looked, you know, absolutely beautiful that night, being paraded in front of you at the Stretford end.
And they wore that cup final replay kit, didn't they, this season?
Yeah.
I think I noticed that's on one of the programme covers from a game I'd been at. The previous match, they'd been wearing the all blue with the yellow socks and numbers.
Yeah, and this yellow stripe down the side of the shorts with the yellow badge. Yeah, I actually bought one of those shirts this year. They charged a fortune for it. They striped everybody up, and it was about 70 quid, I think, for a shirt. Yeah, that's a great kit, an iconic kit, really, that they wore. And I just wish the kits, I mean, it's you know, might be living in the past. I prefer the kits then when they were just like plain and simple. Some of these, I mean, the Man City kit the other night against Chelsea, I mean, it looked like a lemon drop to be quite honest.
That kit has immortalised on your book cover. As modelled by Peter Osgood and Peter Housman. The present Chelsea team, though, we talked about that game against Manchester City. I mean, obviously, that was the game that ensured that Liverpool would win the title. And the fact that Chelsea move a step closer to qualifying for the Champions League again, almost overlooked. But Frank Lampard's doing an amazing job with the young players. And I think even, you know, now that money tap has been turned back on, I get the feeling he's still going to persevere with Mason Mount and Reece James and Tammy Abraham. And you must be pretty exciting time to be a Chelsea fan.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, you know, the season didn't start off well when we got hammered at United, even though we played well that day. I think we showed against Liverpool in that Super Cup when we drew 2-2 with them and only lost some penalties. you know, what we could be capable of. Yeah, and some of these young players, I think, have been brilliant. Mason Mount, I think, has been great, even though amongst the Chelsea, you know, on Twitter, he gets quite a lot of stick. I can't see why. And I think Pulisic, is it Pulisic or Pulisic?
Pulisic, yeah.
Yeah, I think he looks an excellent prospect, especially when you consider, on top of all of this, we lost Hazard last year. Mm. And in a way, I think it's made us more of a team now, because I think we look to Hazard to get us out of games, and not taking anything away from him, because I think he's an incredible footballer. I think we've done really well and signing Werner, and I can't remember the name of the person we've signed from Ajax. Is it Ziyech or something?
Ziyech, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, he played brilliantly against us in that 4-4 draw. And, you know, he was a real pain. I think he scored that night with a header as well.
Yeah. I'm sure if it's always a good idea signing people who are good against you, but...
William turned out all right.
He did indeed.
Yeah, nice. For Shakhtar Donetsk, he was absolutely fantastic. And, yeah. You know, we got here over Tottenham, which was great.
Hmm. Which, of course, is often what matters, isn't it?
It is.
That's great. Brilliant. Okay, that's Neil Fitzsimon, author of Rhapsody in Blue. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Nick.